Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies podcast series. I am your host, Amanda Jean Swain, at the University of California, Irvine. Today, we'll be talking with Julia Mickenberg about her book, American Girls in Red Russia, Chasing the American Dream, published by the University of Chicago Press. And I've been intrigued by American women who went to the Soviet Union since I read Margaret Wetland's memoir, 50 Russian Winters, quite a while ago. So I'm excited to learn about why American women chose to travel to and live in the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 30s, and more about their experiences. And I have to admit, I'm also a little curious to see how someone trained as an Americanist, an American studies scholar, approaches Soviet history. So welcome to New Books in Russian Studies, Julia.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I'd like to start by asking you to tell us a bit about yourself, and especially how you came to be interested in writing this book about American women traveling to the Soviet Union.
Well, that's kind of a long story, how I got interested in this topic. But to go further back, I had long been interested in Russia and Russian history. I graduated from college in 1990, so it was right at the end of the Cold War. And at that time, everybody was studying Russian and Russian language and history. I had, as a child, even been quite interested. My own kind of ethnic background is Russian, and my grandparents had been kind of radicals, and I remember going to the Russian circus as a kid. They went to the Soviet Union in the 70s, brought back a balalaika. So it had been this kind of family interest for me. And then in college, I studied Russian for a couple of years and took courses in Russian history and literature, and had thought actually about becoming a Russian studies major, but I got a little bit, I confess, frustrated at the difficulty of learning Russian. And I was also really interested in American culture, and that wound up just seeming an easier route to go. But I never really let go of the interest in Russian stuff. And my dissertation and what became my first book were on children's literature and the left. And I've really long been a scholar of the American left, and I came to feel that the Soviet Union is this elephant in the room when we talk about the history of the U.S. left. It's kind of this embarrassment, if you will, the attraction of many people, not just communists, but a broad swath of liberals, progressives, in what was happening in the Soviet Union. So that had been in the back of my mind, and trying to grapple with some of that was interesting to me. The specific project that I came to kind of began in what is chapter 3 of the book, the discussion of the American colony at Kuzbass, and the figure of Ruth Epperson Kennell, who was a children's book writer, who I discovered there was a sketch of her by Theodore Dreiser. I had looked in her archive because she was one of the first children's book writers to write these, you know, books about the new Russia, children in Soviet Union, and she published these books in 1931 and 1932. And looking at that, I came to learn about her living in this basically American utopian colony in Siberia in the early 20s. That got me fascinated, but I was particularly interested in what attracted her as a woman. This idea of transforming home life and living communally, getting out of domestic drudgery. It was through her that I both discovered other women, and then when I started looking at scholarship, particularly the scholarship around sort of Americans who were drawn to the Soviet Union, which is not a huge scholarship, there was really nothing out there that was looking at the particular attractions to women. So, and that was also through conversations with some people about, well, where might I actually intervene in an existing conversation, as far as, well, I don't know if you want to ask me, but as far as coming into this as a scholar of American studies, it's a real challenge. And I had a lot of worries about doing that. And I did go back and start studying Russian again, right after getting tenure, which was fun and challenging and humbling. And just read a ton and started going to conferences. And, I definitely, it took me more than 10 years to write the book, but I'm sure there are all kinds of gaps that come from my not having been, you know, trained as a Russianist. But I hope other kinds of perspectives that I bring because of my training.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things I appreciated about the book, that it is oftentimes within our own scholarly fields, certain things are taken as given or just our perspectives are shaped by the field we're in. So having someone who is sort of an outsider to come in and to write this history, I think, as actually makes a great contribution. So I certainly got a lot out of the book. So, and I look forward now to that conversation. But you begin the book by saying that long before the Bolshevik Revolution, that the revolutionary Russian woman had become an almost mythic figure in the United States. And indeed, there is a link between these Russian radicals and Russian radicalism and the engagement with feminist ideas in the United States. So can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. Now I'm not recalling her name, but there's a graduate student at SUNY Binghamton who's writing about this earlier period now. And I found it really fascinating. Part of the point was that I wanted to look at this as not strictly a U.S. something that begins with the Bolshevik Revolution, which it's not. Russia has this particular call as the kind of land of revolution, you know, going back certainly to the 1870s and 80s, but even potentially earlier. There was an organization called the Friends of Russian Freedom, the American Friends of Russian Freedom. Many of the people who founded that organization were children of abolitionists. Some were abolitionists themselves, but the most kind of active person in that organization was Alice Stone Blackwell, who was also an important suffragist. She was an editor of a suffrage journal. Her father was Henry Blackwell, a famous abolitionist, and her mother was Alice Stone, one of the important early feminists. And she worked closely with Emma Goldman, the fiery anarchist, to bring Catherine Breshkovsky, who became known as the little grandmother of the Russian Revolution, to the United States. And more broadly, Breshkovsky was the figure because she was in the United States for almost a year, from 1904 to 1905, and she attracted huge crowds to rallies and personally met a lot of people who were then inspired by her stories of revolutionary struggle and imprisonment and et cetera, exile in Siberia. But there were stories pretty often in the American women's press of various female revolutionaries in Russia who were assassinating terrible people in Russia. And they called themselves terrorists in today's discourse. The terrorist is kind of uniformly considered bad, and they're associated with attacking innocent people. But it was precisely the opposite that the Russian terrorists were doing. They were specifically targeting what they would call kind of enemies of Russian freedom. I don't know if they used that term specifically. So, I found all over. I did searches of different feminist and suffrage journals, and found a lot of articles about different, you know, Maria Spiridonova or Vera Zaslich and other kind of well-known figures in Russia were very highly regarded in the United States. And the fact that they were resorting to violence was a representative of how horrible things had gotten for them, that these, you know, tender, sensitive women would feel no other choice but to resort to violence. And their militance, I think, was a real inspiration for women in the United States who were just becoming radicalized as the feminist movement was heating up in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm certain that this interest pre-1917 and looking across that divide or making that divide a little blurrier is definitely important, because I'm sure that that influenced then people who chose to go to the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 30s. So who were these people? Who were these Americans in general who were going to travel and particularly to live in the Soviet Union after the Bolshevik Revolution?
Well, there's a real range, and I was hoping in the way that I set up the chapters to get at some of this range. So early on, there were people who were going as relief workers during the Russian famine, which starts very shortly while the Civil War is still going on, beginning in the summer of 1921. There I focused on women who joined up with the American Friends Service Committee, the Quaker relief organization. You didn't actually have to be Quaker to join that organization, and a number of people who volunteered to help starving Russians were in fact already radicalized and were trying to find ways to get into the Soviet Union. There was an Allied blockade going on, and the Bolsheviks had also recently restricted immigration. So there were people who were coming in. They certainly shared the humanitarian concerns of other workers, but they were specifically interested in the Russian Revolution. And I talk about them as child savers who were interested in these Russian children as potential child saviors, because there was both the kind of the threat represented by sickly, starving Russian children and the hope of these children who could become, you know, new men and new women who would create socialism. So you had relief workers. You also had people going and joining communes. So Seattle Commune was a famous one. I think there were, now I don't remember the exact number, there were something like 26 communes that were established by foreigners. A large proportion of them were all Americans. And as I mentioned, I talked specifically about the Kuzbas colony, which was quite famous, got a lot of press, particularly because a number of people defected from it and wrote kind of sensational stories in the press. But they were, the people who went to those colonies were, you know, definitely radical and interested in having a hand in building socialism. There were also pretty large numbers of Jews who, a fair number of whom had immigrated to the United States as a result of pogroms, particularly before and after the 1905 revolution. Some of those people now went back after the Bolshevik Revolution and had high hopes for a very different situation. They were attracted, you know, they were impressed by the idea that much of the Bolshevik leadership had, that there were Jews in the Bolshevik leadership. And I mean, Russianists will know about a lot of this stuff, but the Birobidzhan was the Jewish colony that was founded in 1928, had all kinds of complicated problems, but that was an attraction to many Jews in the United States, not necessarily ones who had lived in Russia before, but often the children of these Russian Jewish immigrants. Particularly during the 1930s, you had many people going over who were working class and not necessarily politicized, who went to the Soviet Union simply for jobs, because there was a depression in the United States and lots of work, well-paying work in the Soviet Union. So that was probably the largest moment of American immigration, but it also just became sort of, a lot of those were, there was a combination of engineers and then industrial workers. Most of those people were men. Some of them brought their wives, but a lot of kind of adventurous, more educated women also started going, looking for jobs, teaching, working on newspapers, getting involved in any kind of social service organization. So it started attracting people who were, you know, I talk about the parallel to the American emigration to Paris in the 20s. If you were going to Paris in the 20s, it was like you were sick of, you know, bourgeois American culture and you kind of wanted to get away. It was a kind of dropping out, though, whereas going to the Soviet Union was this sense that you could help build something, create something new. And there was, and I also, people were very interested in the arts in the Soviet Union. So people were going to learn from and witness particularly theater and film. So looking at the work that filmmakers were doing, everybody was seeing tons of theater. I talk also about a group of African-American Harlem Renaissance figures who went in 1932 to work on a film called, it was going to be called Black and White. That was going to be the first honest film about American race relations. And they believed that that film could not be made in the United States, but it could be made in the Soviet Union. And in fact, it could not be made in the Soviet Union. It was canceled because of fears that, or threats that the US would not recognize the Soviet Union, which they did in 1933. They said they wouldn't recognize them if this film was made. So it wasn't, but the people who worked on that film or the cast of the film most famously was Langston Hughes, but I focus on women in that group, including Dorothy West and Louise Thompson Patterson. Many of those people stayed on for a year or more and had amazing experiences. And so, and African Americans in particular were interested in this idea that the Soviets had somehow conquered the race relation problems. And they looked at, particularly at the treatment of Soviet national minorities, which had their own complicated history that Russianists will be quite familiar with. But they saw these parallels between what was happening, how the Soviets were dealing with their race issues in their minds successfully as compared to real failures in the United States. They were also treated extremely well when they were visiting. So they liked that. And I could also say more about the particular things that attracted women.
Well, let's do that because we'll actually talk in more detail about those different categories, but what was it about the new Soviet woman that was particularly appealing to American women who went to the Soviet Union?
So it was on a couple of levels. One was that these, one was the kind of policies and the practices to a certain extent that were put in place shortly after the revolution. So really right after the revolution, marriage laws were changed. So divorce was made easy and simpler. Abortion was made legal and free. In marriages, women could take their, or husbands could take the wives' names. Women gained equal property rights. They had equal pay for equal work. Again, legally, there were problems in getting this to actually happen. There were supposedly dining halls established and childcare facilities so that women could, you know, be released from certain kinds of household duties so that they could work. They were given generous maternity leave policies, all these things that women did not have in the United States, in many cases still do not have in the United States. So these were deemed very attractive. And this, you know, certainly going back to before the revolution, Russian women had had a strong role in revolutionary organizations and had this image of being, certainly not all Russian women, but this, but the radicalized Russian women were educated, thoughtful, involved in you know, the problems of the world and not just a narrow feminine sphere. And so this, the new Russian woman was often, you know, in a way a little bit like the image of the Rosie the Riveter during World War II. So she could, you know, have a beautiful face, but have getting her her hands dirty and kind of, you know, involved in, you know, working, but she could be a mother. She could also be involved in the problems of the world and having this kind of larger access to these larger spheres that many women in the United States would feel that they themselves lacked. So this could be a very attractive image. I think the novel Moscow Yankee by Myra Page really gives this kind of evocative image of that's that speaks to if you think of Page herself as an author who did spend time in the Soviet Union, but clearly admiring these young women as symbolizing this new kind of woman. Some of those fictional depictions are almost more powerful than even the nonfiction ones, but there's plenty of nonfiction too.
So this idea that women did not need to be relegated to kind of maternal work really comes out in the American response to the Civil War. And you talk about how women who became involved in relief work, as you've already mentioned, started to reframe that kind of humanitarian work as serving peace, as being opposed to militarism and imperialism, and away from a kind of a maternal relief work and around just saving children. So can you talk some more about that, and particularly Jessica Smith, who was with the American Friends Service Committee, and you use her as an example of that?
She's a really interesting figure who I, in some ways, wished she doesn't have a collection of papers anywhere. And so I had to gather from bits and pieces about her. But she was active in the National Women's Party, which was the more militant of the two main suffrage organizations in the United States. And then she became the treasurer of a group called the American Women's Emergency Committee, which emerged from the National Woman's Party, and there they used this maternalist rhetoric, but I think quite strategically, demanding milk and medicine for Russian mothers and babies as a reason to end an Allied blockade of Russia. So there was a blockade that had been instituted the United States more unofficially than officially, but it it went on even past the end of World War I, and it was sort of to punish Russia for withdrawing from World War I and making a separate peace from Germany. And so they were saying that this was hurting innocent people rather than the people who were responsible for this. She had been involved in the Intercollegiate Socialist Society, and then she was one of the people who volunteered with the American Friends Service Committee and got sent over to Russia in 1922 or 1923, and she then ultimately takes charge of the AFSC's publicity efforts in Russia. And then this really, I don't know what year she joined the Communist Party, but she becomes a major figure in the American Communist Party and really devoted her entire life to a kind of, I guess you could say publicity work, you could say propaganda work, editing communist publications like Soviet Russia Today and the New World Review. But your question had been about the peace rhetoric. Maybe you could say the question again as I'm kind of wandering here.
That's quite all right. And it's really around this changing of the framing of this work, rather than as women, we are concerned about children and so we have to go help save them, to this idea that by going out and engaging in this relief work, that women were not just being maternal, but that they were actually being active in these other realms in terms of promoting peace and opposing militarism and imperialism. So it's taking this political stance rather than a focus on can women's maternal urgings are going to push them into these situations to care for the children. So that's what I was trying to get at, which reflects also that new Soviet woman idea that she's not sort of bound to act in these maternal ways, but that there are other driving forces.
Yeah, and there was also, I mean, I think there was a very strategic use of a maternalist discourse mm-hmm. to make it socially acceptable for women to be going abroad. I don't think someone like Jessica Smith was as concerned about being socially acceptable as maybe some other people, but I think she was very careful in the rhetoric that she used in publicity pieces that she wrote. And even somebody like Helen Keller talked about, did use this maternal rhetoric to talk about, oh, that children are suffering in this wonderful land. But that kind of rhetoric, even the dancer Isadora Duncan uses, I think there is something actually genuine in that rhetoric of, we're women, we're supposed to be concerned for children, we do care about children. That becomes a kind of gateway though to, or that gives women permission in a sense to enter the wider world. And there's a longer history of that, I think. And legacy of that becoming a way for women to have a certain kind of authority in the public sphere, certainly going, and many of those were women who did not have children of their own. So it's the kind of mothering the world. But as you say, that's also for gaining the authority to go well beyond what we might consider a maternal sphere.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can understand why you became captured by Ruth Epperson Kennell's story. That really is a fascinating story. And she is not just in chapter 3, but reappears at various other points in the book because she had such an extended life and influential life in many ways as an American woman in the Soviet Union. So tell us about how she ended up in this American colony in the Kuzbass. And in particular, how did she reconcile her dreams for a new future with the harsh reality of living in this colony?
I came to conclude, I guess, starting at the end of your question, I came to conclude that suffering was sort of part of the pleasure for, not just for her, but for a lot of people, because it made the experience more authentic in a way. She and her husband were, goes back, but she was kind of dissatisfied with domestic life. She was originally from Oklahoma. She had moved to California. She was working as a children's librarian. She was strongly opposed to World War I, had been involved in kind of socialist/industrial workers of the world, politics and arts in San Francisco, where they lived. And they read a piece in The Liberator, which was a communist newspaper by Mike Gold, who talked about the wanted volunteers for Siberia. And, you know, it seemed like, oh, this is it. This is our chance to go and take part in the revolution, that they and other people had been very excited about it happening. So they read this piece in, they went in 1922. I'm trying to think. Yeah, it must have been in 1922. 2022 that they read it, and they pretty quickly signed up. It was with the Society for Technical Aid to Soviet Russia, which was one of the main organizations that was sponsoring American colonies in Russia. And so they volunteered, got accepted, and went over. There were, I think, four or five different shiploads of Americans who were coming, and she became kind of a central figure in the colony. Just about everybody knew her. So she, and one of the striking things about her story was that she left her, they had, or I shouldn't say she, but she and her husband left their 18-month-old son with the husband's mother, and she was pretty torn about doing this initially, but then there's correspondence with various family members where she was on the one hand having nightmares about leaving her son, but then saying things like, actually, I hardly miss him at all. It's actually fine. And I think she was kind of thrilled by this idea of that she was going over as a worker. Many of the other women who went over went as wives of the workers, but she was going as a worker herself. And she had multiple jobs there. She ran the library that started later. She kind of collected the mail. She was secretary to the main engineer. And then she also kind of took it upon herself to be chronicler of the colony. And she wrote a series of articles published in The Nation, one of which had, I can't remember if that was the title, but she talked about what they were doing as building not a new Atlantis, but a new Pennsylvania, and really talking about it as this kind of continuing the American frontier impulse, but doing it in Siberia. And there, you know, there's comparisons going back to really going back to the 1860s of, you know, the US and Russia, that they have slavery ending almost the same time as serfdom. They both have this expansive frontier region with native populations. And so Siberia has this kind of resonance somehow with the American West and this frontier region that they can expand and have new possibilities at this moment where possibilities seem to be ending in the United States. How does she reconcile her kind of dreams for the experience with what she finds there? I mean, what she found there was, you know, there were all kinds of petty disputes about the communal living, and that she very much got caught up in. She had a very complicated relationship with the women who went as dependents, and who she considered them sort of parasites, unfairly, I think. Part of what's striking about her story, of course, is that she fell in love when she got there, or shortly after she got there, and her husband left in a dispute between the IWWs or Wobblies and communists, and she stayed on. She said she wanted to fulfill her contract. They had a two-year contract, but actually she had met this other guy, another American who was a communist and an engineer. And it was almost like her sort of political awakening was accompanied by a sexual awakening. And she wrote a piece, she wrote several pieces in the American Mercury, didn't refer to her own experience, but she says that she, that several marriages, I guess, fell apart, usually on the wives' initiative. And so this seemed to be a somewhat common thing of women getting there and discovering all new things about themselves. It was like a whole set of social possibilities opening. And so even though there were all kinds of disappointments, it was still very exciting to feel like there were all kinds of new possibilities of trying out other ways of living socially, interpersonally, everything else. I found her a very troubling figure in all kinds of ways. partly because she was leaving her child, how she treated her husband, how she reconciled certain things that were happening in the Soviet Union. But I also found her sympathetic in lots of ways. And certainly there was something familiar about the kinds of struggles that she was going through, because I think it's, you know, any woman with career aspirations or kind of searching for something more winds up having many of these same kinds of struggles, and maybe making some of the same, not the same precisely, but similar kinds of compromises in order to try to get what they think they want. And I guess what was most troubling about her is that she seemed to have a critical consciousness through the 1920s. And at a certain point, she develops this very interesting relationship with Theodore Dreiser, because after her time in the at the Kuzbass colony, she moved to Moscow and started working in the Comintern as a librarian. And then she was hired as Dreiser's private tour guide during his Russian tour, 1927 to 1928. And she remained pretty open-eyed about a lot of what was going on, but in correspondence with Dreiser, which continued for the rest of his life, I could almost tell the moment that she joined the Communist Party, probably around 1935. And then it's like she loses all that critical distance and becomes a kind of Stalinist mouthpiece and much less interesting as a figure, I have to say. But she then was defending the Soviet Union for the rest of her life. And in the 1970s, wrote a book about Theodore Dreiser in the Soviet Union, as a way of speaking to the young radicals of the 1960s and saying, you know, see, this very important man of letters was interested in this place that you shouldn't be dismissing as for its radical possibilities today. So she's a strange and complicated figure.
Yeah, a lot of the women are strange and complicated figures. And another yes. one along those lines is Anna Louise Strong, who yes. is another powerful personality and was asked to start the English language Moscow News in 1930, although she had already had quite a bit of engagement with the Soviet Union in the 1920s. So tell us about her. How did she come to the Soviet Union, and how did she come to this very powerful position of establishing the English language kind of organ of communication on behalf of the Soviet Union?
Well, it would seem to be a powerful position, but she learned quickly that she had much less power than she thought she did. But she's she's another figure who I guess I found her especially tragic because she had such idealism about the Soviet Union that, you know, she was aware of things not being as wonderful as she made them out to be. She was arguably, I would say, the sort of biggest American, the word propaganda is a word that has multiple kinds of resonances, but arguably she was the biggest American propagandist for the Soviet Union. Although I think that she felt that what she was writing was true, but she left out things that she knew because it didn't help to create the world that she was wanting to create through her work. But the way that she got to the Soviet Union was she also joined with the American Friends Service Committee. She was somewhat disingenuous in her application because she had asked specifically to go to Russia, and they said that she couldn't go. She was already known as a radical at that time. She had been involved in the Seattle general strike and working at a socialist paper there in 1919, and she volunteered specifically to go to Russia. They told her she could go to Poland. And she went to Poland, and then once news of famine in Russia came out, she basically told her immediate supervisor that she was going to Russia and didn't wait for an answer from the headquarters in Philadelphia. And by the time they realized she was there, it was kind of too late to stop her. And then she gets typhus and nearly died, and they had to spend a lot of money with a private nurse who died taking care of her. But at that point, and even though she'd had, you know, terrible, you know, difficulty and trials when she got there, she had sort of like, that's all right, I'm dedicated to this place. She saw, you know, so much death and tragedy, but it made her kind of more determined that you know, she was very inspired by what she called the creators in chaos, people who she thought were still idealistic and making things happen and not deterred by all the difficulties, and wanted to be one of those. So she kind of made it her business to be writing to, in a way that common Americans would understand, about what was happening in Russia. So she was writing for many different American magazines, and she was living in Moscow, but she would go back every year to the United States and give lectures. She was the, in 1924, she got made chief, I guess they called her, of the John Reed colony on the Volga, which was a colony for children who were too young for children's homes, but too old to be on their own. And she wrote all kinds of pamphlets and a book, and raised lots of money for this colony before eventually, you know, bailing on it and deciding it was that the money was being mismanaged. There were Russian bureaucrats who were trying to extort money from her if she, you know, for the colony ostensibly, but they seemed to be not using the money properly that she was getting them. Again, this didn't deter her from still supporting the revolution. And when the opportunity came to start this English language newspaper, this seemed like the great opportunity. She had really wanted to do something for the Americans who were living in Moscow, which by the time the paper was started in 1930s, there was quite a large community, at least 1,000 people. So this became a paper specifically geared at technical experts who were there. And she wanted a paper that would be independent, which somewhat naive to believe that there could even be such a paper. But that would be, you know, fun to read and even funny, and would have news, you know, would be supportive of what's going on, but would be independent and would have news of sports events and theater and things of interest to the community, and would also keep people informed who maybe weren't speaking English. But she very quickly was relegated to the sidelines as various Russian bureaucrats or communists were taking over. And there's a kind of striking scene in her autobiography, which was this sort of stunning story of her complaining about all the machinations of people taking over and not letting her do things the way she wanted to on the newspaper. And she actually got a personal meeting with Stalin, and describes him in almost godlike terms. She was totally thrilled in meeting with him. And she, it's featured in her memoir. She had hoped that this memoir was going to gain her entrance into the Communist Party. But what's also striking about her story is that she was neither the Russian or the American Communist Party wanted her. And so there were, she also had a lot of personal, I mean, one of the other things that was interesting about writing that chapter on the Moscow News is that I had access to the papers of not just her, but a number of women who had been correspondents on the Moscow News. And so I was able to see different sides of the same picture. And so she would sort of worry that people didn't like her. And then I would read other people's correspondence and they were actually making fun of her, you know, joking about her as this, you know, pushy and overwhelming work ethic and driving everybody crazy and a little too starry eyed. You know, particularly this figure of Millie Bennett, who was her housemate and was a kind of hard boiled journalist who had a little more skepticism about what was going on. But again, even if she acted like she was skeptical, winds up staying in the Soviet Union for 6 years and ultimately joining the Communist Party as well. So,
yeah, and that was actually my next question was Millie Bennett, who seems to be less inclined to look at what's happening in the Soviet Union through these kind of rose-colored glasses of propaganda. And yet she also still stays. And I think that this, what you talked about at the beginning about this ambivalence or kind of complicated relationship between the American left and the Soviet Union, is really playing out in very, you know, tangible ways in these women as they're there working and believing in these ideals, and yet also seeing, particularly in the 30s, the more destructive sides of the system. So can you talk more about Millie and how she approached this and you know how she tried to deal with those discrepancies? And
I mean, one of the things that I was particularly trying to get at was the disjuncture between, or what often was a disjuncture between people's private writings in, you know, in diaries and letters or memoirs that were often unpublished and what they wrote about publicly. And Millie Bennett's correspondence with her friends is very funny and fun to read, but she was constantly, you know, cracking jokes about everything that was happening in the Soviet Union and also telling people, you know, assuring people that she was only going to stay a year. And also her ability to joke about things that were actually quite horrifying was fascinating. I mean, I guess the biggest one was that she had gotten involved with an actor who was younger than her, who had supposedly had a homosexual past, and sodomy was not made officially illegal, I believe, until maybe 1933. But she had married this guy, and he was arrested and he was sent to a colony in Siberia, and she wrote these letters of like, he's doing folk dances to, you know, for the revolution and agitprop. She just kind of made jokes about him. And you know, how does she reconcile? She also by 1935, she wrote something in the New York Times that was kind of justifying or explaining why, I guess it would have been 36, why the Soviets had outlawed abortion and why that was reasonable, although in her private writing she was very critical of the laws, of the law outlawing abortion. I think in some letters to friends she talked about, I think in the most striking thing she said is something like, it's like any other faith. You see things that, you know, are terrible, and you tell yourself, well, the facts don't matter. And it was like the larger project of building socialism seemed like such a worthy goal to her that, and to many people, I think that there was this sense of, well, maybe these particular awful things are costs of it. She would seem to have open eyes, but they couldn't be that open if she was able to rationalize things that admittedly did, you know, shock and appall her. And sometimes it was almost like it was so interesting and fascinating to be there that it was, and that was another thing that she talked about, that life just seems so dull in the United States compared to living in the Soviet Union. I don't know if she ever fully rationalized or justified it. I think she did believe in socialism as a project. I think joining the Communist Party may be something that she did for practical reasons. Lisa Kirschenbaum has also written about her in her book that looks at the import of the Spanish Civil War, and in part as a distraction from the Moscow trials, but this kind of triangle between Moscow and Barcelona or Madrid and New York, of these different migrations. But Bennett was, I think, in Spain when she joined the Communist Party, and it may have been a question of just getting more access in joining the party. But she was somebody who I loved reading her work. She also, I thought, managed to write these sketches that captured something, the kind of almost non-political, but the sort of quotidian poetic aspects of life in Moscow. So she was, it's partly I just really liked her writing. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. And you've already mentioned the 22 African Americans who went to the Soviet Union in the early 1930s to participate in this film that in the end didn't get made. But again, thinking about this idea of looking for a new society that would eradicate what were real problems, you know, in the United States. How did these, particularly the 8 African-American women who are part of this group, see this experience in the Soviet Union? Where was it fulfilling for them? And where did they see conflict between the claims of a race-free or a racially blind society and the actual practice of life in the Soviet Union?
I mean, one of the things was that they, you know, the Scottsboro case in the United States, in which a group of, I think it was 13 African-American young men, they were called the Scottsboro Boys, but they weren't 13. I think it was 9 of them. The youngest was 13. They were arrested for supposedly raping 2 white women. The case generated a ton of attention in the Soviet Union, and so and the faces of the Scottsboro Boys, and these were, I think, mostly illiterate, very working class, very dark skinned. They were everywhere in the Soviet Union, and so when these actors were recruited and arrived, many Russians were disappointed to see these kind of light-skinned, well-dressed, articulate African-Americans who didn't fit their idea of these kind of ultimate proletarian figures of what African-Americans were like. And I think that was a certain amount of a surprise and a disappointment to the African-Americans who got there, and recognizing that there were certain culture expectations for them. And of course, there were also disappointments that when it started to become clear that the film was not going to be made. The women in the group were attracted for some of the same reasons that white women and Jewish women, other women were drawn to the Soviet Union, seeing women in all these different kinds of public roles. And they were also really interested in members of the group. A pretty big portion of the group, after the film was canceled, went to Soviet Central Asia and were looking at the treatment of Soviet national minorities. And there's a lot of interest in the unveiling of Muslim women. And some of that had actually taken place at gunpoint. It wasn't necessarily this liberatory thing, but what they saw it as a totally liberatory thing. And they saw these women who had been, you know, absolutely hidden from public view, now unveiling and cutting, bobbing their hair and becoming leaders in their communities and becoming outspoken against violent husbands. And some of the people they met were dark skinned and looked like them and had assumed this very large role in public life. And they also, you know, they themselves were treated like celebrities. There was some awareness, though, of this kind of, I don't know what the, treating them as kind of primitives and not really as on the same level as other Westerners. So the African-Americans, communists, African-American communists who were going for training in the Soviet Union, they went to a different, they didn't go to the Lenin School, they went to the, what is it, KU, the school for the Toilers of the East. So they were with Arab and African and Indian cadres, so that they weren't, you know, they were considered sort of apart from others. I had that discussion of the African Americans in the film in, I have two chapters that are looking at performance. So I was interested, other people have written about that film. I was interested in thinking about it in terms of performance and this kind of longer history of African Americans in the Soviet Union. And in a sense, there was a certain kind of recognition that they were being asked to perform their blackness. There's a striking scene where Dorothy West met, Stanislavski? No, it wasn't Stanislavski. Oh my gosh. Met a famous Russian theater person whose name is escaping me. And he had been told that she was a great dancer. It was somebody did it to make a trick and he was trying to get her to dance and she refused and finally ran out crying and then found out that this was a trick played, that he had been told that she was this incredible dancer, but she was so modest that she wouldn't perform. So again, this assumption that all Black people know how to dance and know how to sing and all these stereotypes that were there about African Americans, I think was something that was disappointing to them, mm-hmm. even though there was much that really thrilled them, not least of which was going from a segregated society to being treated like royalty while they were there.
And in your book, you do also look at World War II, and obviously there's a change at that point, and the Soviet Union and the United States become allies against Nazi Germany. What role did women play in establishing, maintaining, facilitating that relationship as allies in World War II between the Soviet Union and the United States?
So in some ways they play a symbolic role. There's a lot, you know, I find it echoing the depictions of women, female revolutionaries. You had a lot in the American press that were looking at women who were working as snipers or partisans or somehow involved in military operations, which was quite striking to American women who now were taking roles in factories, but certainly were not in combat like the Russian women. But I also talk about women like particularly Margaret Bourke White and Lillian Hellman, who actually went to the front and were writing articles and books. Margaret Bourke White had a radio program with her husband at the time where they were broadcasting from Russia, and she was also doing photographs and articles. And then Hellman she was going to do a documentary that didn't happen, but she worked on a film that became one of the most popular Hollywood films about Russia. So you had women as important, these Russian women as important symbols of the bravery of the Russian people, but you also had American women who were, in a sense, helping to get out those ideas of our brave Russian allies, and look at the wonderful things they're doing, and look at the things that women in particular are doing. So yeah, that's what I was looking at in that chapter. And I talk about World War II as a kind of moment of reviving some of the discourses that were really impossible to sustain in the late 1930s during the Great Terror. And in fact, when it was very hard to say almost anything good about the Soviet Union, you still, and particularly in the left-wing press, find lots of articles about, you know, Russian children and their education, and about Russian women and how good they have it with the, you know, the working conditions and the time off from work. So that became a kind of focus at a time that many had become very, on the left as well, had become very critical of the Soviet Union, particularly you know, with the Moscow trials and the terror, and then with the Nazi-Soviet pact. So the entry of United States into World War II as allies of the Russian becomes a kind of last gasp of this discourse that you see in the 20s and up until about the mid-1930s. Mm-hmm. So.
In your epilogue, you turn to the question of American women spying for the Soviets. And obviously this is not necessarily something that came out of the research that you did. In fact, you talk specifically about one case that was explicitly spying. But you do say that the book has addressed the question of loyalty. And how do you see that in the work that you've done through this book on American women traveling to the Soviet Union, living in the Soviet Union, speaking on behalf of the Soviet Union back to the United States and to the broader world? What does that lead you to think about this question of loyalty?
I mean, it's a really complicated question, because I think, you know, most of these women thought of themselves as internationalists and kind of citizens of the world. But I think in general, they also thought of themselves as good Americans, and maybe speaking to a kind of vision of the United States that they feared being lost, and an overemphasis on kind of capitalist gain or whatever. I felt that I had to bring up spying because I didn't want to be accused of not examining it as an issue. Most of the people who went were not spies. but I did find some examples of people who were, and I also found, I mean, I think the most striking thing for me in researching that question is I started wondering, like, what does it even mean? To be a spy. And again, like, what exactly is one supposed to be loyal to? Are you supposed to be loyal to, you know, my country, right or wrong? Are you supposed to be loyal to an ideal that you think is just? And of course, so many people were so loyal to the ideal of communism that they overlooked so many horrible things that were happening in the Soviet Union. And so at the same time, that same ideal also inspired people, particularly in the United States, to do a lot of really good, important stuff, like helping unemployed and fighting for unions and working for justice for African Americans. There were many things that people did. And then the loyalty question, you know, it made me particularly in the light of McCarthyism and people feeling like, you know, they were unjustly accused of, again, of what, you know, even being a communist was not actually a crime, but by, you know, nobody was, very few people were open communists because it would threaten your job, your livelihood, your public reputation. And even within the Communist Party, people had different kinds of relationships to the Soviet Union. So yeah, I kind of move in that chapter between talking about actual questions of espionage to the larger question of what did it mean to devote so much energy to this other country that becomes sort of public enemy number one for the United States, and what did that mean for their own relationship to their home country. And I think it's different for different people. There's not a single kind of an answer, and different, you know, I was interested in the ways that people's identities were, their whole very identity was shaped by spending time in Russia. One of the people we didn't talk about is the dancer Pauline Kohner, but like, and I don't think she was ever in the Communist Party. I'm sure she was never a spy. But this whole part of her whole dance career was in many ways shaped by the years that she spent in the Soviet Union, right around the time that the Great Terror is starting. And then how does she tell that story when later in life? So I don't feel that I've really adequately answered that question.
No, I mean, I think it's a huge question, and that's why I wanted to hear some of your thoughts. One of the things I enjoy about this these podcast interviews, when I was listening to them and now having an opportunity to host them, is that there are big questions that come out of a lot of these books, and to have a chance to talk through that and not just kind of read a paragraph or two is really fascinating to me. The other kind of big question or big idea in the book, and you talk about this American feminist attraction to Russia, telling us something about who and where we are now and about embracing other forms of cruel optimism. What do you mean by that term? And what, stepping back and looking at this as a whole, what can we learn about that, not just about these women, but about some bigger questions about how women find their way in society and this balance of optimism and sacrifice, or whatever else you mean by that term, cruel optimism. It's quite the term.
It's not my term. I can't take credit for it. Yeah. The term comes from Lauren Berlant, and it's sort of like, she refers to it as really wanting something that's actually not good for you. And hoping for it, that it will happen, and it's a bad thing for you. I guess I think about other kinds of cruel optimism, like women who, you know, aspire to becoming corporate executives and then realize how dissatisfied they are when they get to the top of the corporate ladder and what they're sacrificing to get there. And, what they're giving up, I don't think there is a simple solution. I think part of the attraction of the Soviet Union was that it wasn't utopian. It was actually happening, right? And they were practically going to solve all of these social and economic issues. And, you know, that it required violence and repression to do that suggests it was not simple or easy at all. And I do think that there are more equitable and just ways of running a society. You know, some of the Scandinavian countries are doing adapting aspects of state socialism that are not, you know, certainly not involving this level of violence and repression. But I do think we're at this really interesting moment now where Russia's very much in the news. They're talking about a kind of second Cold War, and we're also at a really interesting moment for women with, the Women's March being the biggest protest in, I think, ever, world over. And why is it around women that that people are becoming politicized? It was, you know, partly, I think, because of, Trump's insulting remarks about women. But I think it's this kind of recognition of here we are in this advanced state, and so many things haven't changed. You know, what changed after women got the vote? Not very much. And the ERA never passed, but what would it have meant if it did actually pass? Like, the problems around race, there's a kind of optimism that comes after the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964. But then there's a kind of anger and then a disillusionment because these problems of racism and sexism are so deeply entrenched in our society. And so to think that there's going to be some kind of easy, simple solution, I think, is a kind of cruel optimism, because it's not going to be that easy.
Yes. So, mm-hmm. Well, thank you for talking to us about American Girls in Red Russia. And this really was a fascinating book, and the women that you portray are just amazing personalities in their own rights, but it also, as I hope this conversation has shown, raises a lot of really interesting and thought-provoking questions about both their experiences and how we think about these kinds of utopias and engagement in utopias. So I'd like to close today by taking you to the present and ask what you're working on now.
So right now I'm doing I'm working on a much more kind of limited project, which is nice because this one was a little too vast in scope. I'm just doing an edition of Madeline Doty's writings on the Russian Revolution. She's mentioned in the book, but she's not a major figure. But there is a series of books being published about Americans encountering revolutionary Russia. And Doty is an interesting figure, and her account has not gotten as much attention. She wrote a book called Behind the Battle Lines, which is supposedly focusing on women during World War I. And she went to a number of different countries. She said she traveled around the world, but at least half of her book is about Russia because she just pretty serendipitously landed in St. Petersburg, like just days after the Bolshevik coup. And even though she does have a chapter on Russian women, she was sort of too caught up in everything else that was happening to focus exclusively on Russia. So I've just been, wrote an introduction to that. And she's a kind of quintessential new woman, so very interesting figure in that way. And then also footnoting the portion of the book that's dealing with the Bolshevik Revolution. And looking ahead, I'm also working on an article that's looking at the first Red Scare. We're coming in the United States. We're coming up on the anniversary of the first Red Scare around 1919, and the relationship of feminists to that, which is building on an article that I published several years back that was looking at the suffrage struggle in the United States and how the Russian Revolution became a foil in that. And one of the things that I found in researching this book is the real interest among feminists in Russia and the Soviet Union was something that historians had been sort of afraid to look at because it would seem to validate the accusations of Bolshevism that were leveled against feminists at the time. And I think you can talk about their actual interest in Russia without validating those claims. So kind of complicating the story of the relationship between feminism and the Red Scare by bringing Russia into that story or the revolution. So those are a couple of the things I'm working on now.
Yeah, well, those sound like great projects and will certainly contribute even further to the scholarly conversation that this book contributes to. And so I want to thank you again. I really appreciate that you took the time to talk to me today about this book. And I also want to thank our listeners for joining us. And we hope that you enjoyed this interview with Julia Mickenberg, and that we look forward to next month's conversation about a new book in Russian studies.